From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2013, when two men with vastly different life experiences formed an unlikely friendship. Pardeep Kalika was mourning the loss of his father, a leader in his Sikh community in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Satwant Singh Kalika had moved his family to the United States from India in 1982, hoping to escape the violence in the northern state of Punjab. Pardeep was 6 years old at the time. Decades later, his family would see a different kind of violence, a mass shooting, where a white supremacist targeted their Sikh temple. Satwant Singh Kalika, the temple's president, was one of six people who were killed in that shooting that happened on August 15, 2012. Now, after his father's murder, Pardeep Kalika was in search of answers, and that search took him to an unexpected place. A year after his father's death, he sat down with a man who helped create the racist skinhead gang that produced his father's killer. Arno Michaelis had become deeply involved in the white power movement at the age of 17. He says emotional violence was the norm at home, where alcoholism shaped family life. He became a bully at school. He had a swastika tattooed on his middle finger. And he helped form the Hammerskins Nation, which would become the largest racist skinhead organization on the planet, really, in the world. And Michaela says at age 24, everything changed for him. It was the year he became a single father. He realized that it didn't change his ways. The street violence he had come to know, and that had taken some of his friends, would take his daughter as well. He worried about that, and he began his journey of seeking forgiveness, a life after hate. Michaela says it took him a long time to work through his feelings of guilt and remorse for the harm he had caused. He wrote about his transformation in a memoir and in an online magazine, both titled Life After Hate. Pardeep Kalika heard about Michaela's work, and the two decided to meet. They formed a lifelong friendship now over conversations about the roots of hate, violence, and about forgiveness. They co-authored a book titled The Gift of Our Wounds, A Sikh and Former White Supremacist Find Forgiveness After Hate, and they formed an educational organization called Serve to Unite, which encourages young people of all backgrounds to become peacemakers. The two men will share their stories and their message at an upcoming event at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester's Levine Center to End Hate. But first, they join us from Milwaukee for this conversation on connections. Welcome to Pardeep Kalika, co-author of The Gift of Our Wounds. Pardeep, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing good. Good afternoon.
Well, thank you for joining us. And Arno Michaelis, the co-author of Gift of Our Wounds as well. Arno, thanks for taking the time. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well and grateful to be on with you today.
We're grateful to have you. And joining us here in Rochester in our studio here at WXXI is Karen Elam, director of the Levine Center to End Hate at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you so much.
Why don't you remind our listeners the mission of the Levine Center and why you wanted to put this particular event together?
Thank you. So the mission is to unite the Greater Rochester community in overcoming hate through education, dialogue, and positive action. And we learned about Arno Michaelis and Pardeep Kalika and their story, incredibly powerful story, and we knew that they would be the right messengers to bring to our community to kick us off into a series of dialogues that will follow after this event, where we really will bring people together that may not normally come together and begin to have dialogue and look at ways that we can eliminate hate.
The event 1 week from tonight. Tell us about it.
So it is at the Lyric Theater at 7 p.m. It is tickets can be purchased on our website, which is endhaterock.org. Please do go and purchase tickets, $10, because we are selling out. So I really encourage people. The capacity is almost met, a capacity of 750, and we're well over 650 at this point.
All right. Tickets, 10 bucks. That's it.
That's it.
$10. The Lyric Theater is a wonderful venue, and the event, Why Do We Hate, next Thursday night at 7 p.m. One more time, your website where people can find it.
Yes, endhaterock.org.
Arno and Pardeep, our producer, Megan Mack, and I had a chance to see a lot of your work that you've done together in various talks and settings around the country. And in watching the way you tell your story, I think anybody who comes next Thursday night is going to be moved in a very, very significant way. And we're going to talk about your story and your backgrounds in just a moment here. But one of the things I wanted to ask you right out of the gate here, and I guess I'll start with Pardeep and then I'll ask Arno to follow, is, you know, I'm thinking about what you're going to do in Rochester a week from tonight. And no doubt there's going to be hundreds of people there who probably are ready to stand up and cheer you already. I do wonder, are you also occasionally attracting people who come in with suspicions, who come in doubting the message and maybe would be impacted? I mean, in other words, are you preaching to sort of a choir, and it's hard not to, or are you finding that you are talking to people who might have some hesitations at first? Pardeep?
Yeah, great question. We as of late, we do speak to the choir quite a bit, but you know, the thing about the choir is that we need the choir to sing and sing loudly.
Sure.
We have been getting the people that are not just you know, they're not just weary or like they're contentious, and sometimes people are coming to these events, and that's we want them to come. We want people to come and challenge this message of kindness and compassion and love, and really in the aftermath of hate, how can we move forward as a country together? And we welcome that. I think you know, that's facing a divisive nation, and the divisiveness that we have, that's going to have to actually be confronted, and confronted with love. So we welcome that as well.
Arno, go ahead too. Yeah.
Yeah, I can never blame anybody who doubts me. I've done horrible things and I deserve to be doubted. So I don't begrudge anyone who doesn't buy my story of redemption out of the gate. I do appreciate the opportunity to tell the story and people who listen to it. And I found that most often people who have listened to the story and engaged with me walk away with a different opinion. I hear quite often, I wasn't even going to come to this talk, or I really came in here with doubts, but afterwards they're glad that they were there, and that dialogue is really important.
Yeah, Arno, later this hour I will read a series of questions from you that I have from a local white nationalist who knows you're coming and has some, I think, some honest questions. I think your perspective may help with a lot of people in various places around the country, including here in Rochester. And I, for one, having taken a look at your work and read your work and watched what you and Pardeep are doing, I don't doubt you for one second, but I also appreciate the forthright way that you tell that part of yourself right out of the gate. So let's kind of go back to through your histories. Pardeep, you and your family, talk about coming to this country and tell us about your story and frankly, also your own battles to kind of understand your own identity growing up.
Yeah, you know, we came here in 1982. I was 6 years old. My brother was 4 years old. During the time we came to Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the Midwest, there was a lot of jobs available for incoming immigrants or those that were just coming out of high school. And shortly after we came here, a lot of those jobs left town and sort of started some of the contention that exists within our city and within our state. You know, we lived the typical immigrant life at that time. We moved around quite a bit from apartment to apartment. My father and mother trying to find, you know, just a place to call home. And me and my brother, as we grew up, we were trying to find an identity and who we really were. At that time, there weren't a lot of Indians or Sikhs or Punjabis, maybe only five or six families that lived within the proximal area. And with that said, there was a lot of questioning of, who am I? Am I black enough to be black, white enough to be white, Indian enough to be Indian, American enough to be American? And, you know, as you're growing up, I think a lot of kids ask themselves that. The beautiful part about it, as you grow and become who you were meant to be, you realize that some of that difficulty of attaching onto an identity actually allowed you to be yourself. And that's a beautiful place to be when you're 43 years old. But it sucks as you're growing up, mm-hmm. because all you want to do is to find a group that you belong to and stake your identity in. That was really my upbringing. As I got older, I became a police officer. I became a police officer in one of the roughest parts of Milwaukee. There's a documentary around where I policed. It's called 53206. It has the highest incarcerated rate of black males. And really talks about the history of why that exists. And, you know, after 5 years of policing, I became an educator and I started working with at-risk high school youth. And really the time that me and Arnold met, I was on summer break when August 5th, 2012 happened, and really made me evaluate what can we do going forward to help bring people together.
Tell me about your father.
Sure. I was actually joking when it's been about 7.5 years, almost 8 years. And it's when I think back about my father, I think back about him fondly. When somebody's passed, you sometimes forget a lot of the angst that existed during the time when you had a living relationship. And there's a lot of forgiveness that's given because you understand the difficulty that he had as a first generation immigrant who, you know, he was just trying to navigate the culture and create a world for his children that they could grow up in. And I think that is a typical immigrant mindset to create. And this is a typical American mindset too. You want to create a world better for your children than the one that you inherited. And he was definitely that way. So oftentimes, when I think about my father, I think about him in how creative he was. And creative, I mean, that he could turn a tragic situation and really make it much better and make it funny. I'll give you a small anecdote. He was hosting a group of religious individuals from out of town, and they were going to a car wash. And as they were going to a car wash, my father never really bought brand new cars. He bought salvaged vehicles. And so the vehicles wouldn't work all that great, but he was the president of the Sikh temple, so he would have to host, you know, religious dignitaries that were coming in from out of town. And he decides that he's going to show off a car wash. And so he takes them into this self-service car wash, and this is a nice summer day, and he's got his sunroof down. And as he's approaching and going in, we all kind of recall, oh, do I got my sunroof up or down? He's got his sunroof down, and he's starting to put it up, and he's already in line to go into the car wash. But the salvage vehicle couldn't get the sunroof down or back up. And he's trying and trying and trying, and then realizing that he's just going to have to bear the brunt of taking all the rain into the vehicle with these dignitaries in town. And these dignitaries had on, like, white suits. And, they're going through this car wash. They can't stop it. They can't go back. And sometimes that's our lives. We can only go through it, and we have to make the best of what we have by doing so. And he's going through it, and he is these dignitaries are like, you know, they're in shock, and he's just laughing. And they're looking at him like he's just strange, and he's just laughing at all this water and soap coming into the car. And as he's getting out, he goes through the dryer extra slow. So he's got the windows down now, all of the windows down, and he's going through the dryer extra slow to try to get everybody dry. And he gets out of it, and he looks at these dignitaries, and he's like, you gotta love America. Everything is automatic, including the baths and the drying and everything. And they're just horrified, but he's just having a great time. So obviously that they had a story to tell after that. But that was the way that he was. He made the best out of situations.
That's Chardi Kala, right, my friend?
That's Chardi Kala, yeah. You're right.
So tell me, Chardi Kala is a Sikh principle. Tell me about Chardi Kala.
Sure. Chardi Kala means relentless optimism. And the entire quote, we say it before we get out of service every Sunday. And the whole quote is Nanak Nam Chardi Kala Tere Bane Sarbat Tapala, meaning for the peace and prosperity of all mankind, we shall be relentlessly optimistic. And I think that is, in these divisive times, that's really important to keep in the front of our consciousness.
Tell me about the day that you lost him.
Sure. The day that we lost him was a Sunday, a normal Sunday, August 5th. This is summertime. Most of the people that get there early at the Gurdwara are the ones that are super devout. So he was there. My mom was there. I was on my way. We'll talk about this in the talk a little bit, but it was just the fortunate circumstances that my daughter forgot a notebook at the house, that we were also not inside the Gurdwara at the time. So we got there shortly when the shooting was happening and when everything was going on. That day, him and five others were murdered by a white supremacist named Wade Michael Page, who belonged to the same organization that Arnold and that we alluded to earlier in the broadcast founded years ago.
So before we move forward from there in your relationship, let's talk to Arno about how he got there. Now, Arno, you have talked about growing up in a family that, you know, you were not poor. You had two parents at home who loved you. You had adults who were good to you. But there was alcohol and maybe some volatility in that sense in your household. And the way I have seen you describe yourself is the kind of kid who you started to learn that if you lashed out in different ways, it got you attention, and that the more you did it, the more you got, even if it was negative attention. So you start bullying kids on the bus, and then things sort of escalate. But when did you really start to feel, you know, when are your first memories of saying that, you know, thinking like, hey, if I do this, if I know it's wrong or if it feels wrong, I'm going to do it because, you know, I don't care if it, in your words, as you say, pisses people off.
Yeah, I don't think the issue was so much attention. I got a ton of attention, almost too much attention. My earliest memories, all the adults in my life would be gushing about what a brilliant, gifted genius I was and how wonderful I was. And I think because I was witnessing my mother's suffering and not feeling wonderful, I kind of set out to say, well, I'm not wonderful, I'm horrible. And if you don't believe me, watch what I'm going to do to this kid. Like, watch what I'm going to do to your school. And I think my antisocial behavior was more a matter of stimulation. Yeah, I was looking for something, for thrills. Alcoholism is a genetic disease, and a very common trait of alcoholics is being an adrenaline junkie, which I was from day one. And there can be healthy ways to manage that, but I didn't manage it in a healthy way. And I should say, I failed miserably to engage with all sorts of healthy ways that were offered to me. And I just kept kind of gravitating back towards negative ways. And I don't know that it was really I needed attention. It was just I needed to blow off steam. I needed to keep myself amused. And looking back, a lot of it was very sociopathic. I was a pretty messed up kid. That's what started the antisocial behavior. And as I grew up, it just I needed to keep escalating it to kind of get the same thrill. As an alcoholic myself, I recall the first time I drank beer at age 14, I probably had four or five beers and passed out. And when I quit drinking 20 years later, my magic number was 18 beers. That's how much beer I could drink in an evening and still function the next day. So it's an example of the escalating amount of substance you need to get high. And as a kid, my substance was pissing off teachers, scaring kids, like creating fear, creating chaos. And it always needed to escalate. So that's what brought me to the point where I was 16 and already a full-blown alcoholic, accustomed to violence. I'd been violent since I was a little kid, and hate was just another part of the rush. And that's who I was when I was exposed to white nationalist ideology via white power skinhead bands.
So music with sort of hate speech. And again, let me just sort of pause and ask you a question on this particular layer of your life. We hear some people talk about kids who are 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, who are bullies or who bully other kids. And I want to be careful with sort of that person first language, but who bully other kids, who hurt people in probably the same ways that you did. And sometimes we say, well, that's a bad kid. And I'm always careful about that because you never know what someone is going through. You want people to be accountable. You want people to be responsible. But how do you feel about this urge that some people have to say, well, that kid's just a bad kid?
Well, I definitely appreciate your mindfulness there because I kind of live by the truth that hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. It's actually like a tool you can use on a day-to-day basis, is whether it's somebody just cutting you off in traffic or somebody being really hateful and violent. You remind yourself they're acting that way because they're suffering. And that doesn't mean it's okay. It doesn't mean it's acceptable. It doesn't mean you lie down and take it. But it just means that you understand that that behavior comes from suffering, and it allows you to respond with compassion rather than aggression, which is only going to feed the behavior. And actually, the aggression is what those people are trying to provoke. So it comes down to a tactical approach. If you want to prevail in this conflict, you can't let your opponent make the rules. And if you respond to aggressive people with aggression, you're literally putty in their hands.
Yeah, and the reason I'm kind of interjecting here to ask about this particular part of your life is because I'm thinking about kids, hurt kids now, who maybe have, every kid's different, every person's different, but similar circumstances to yours. I'm worried about what the future of their life looks like. I'm worried about what the present of their life looks like. And you say that some of the interventions offered to you didn't really work, that you didn't take them. Do you think anything would have worked with you, and do you think we need to do different things for kids who are suffering now?
Yeah, absolutely. What I really have a lot of confidence would have worked for me would have been martial arts. I think there's a huge gender component to violent extremist ideologies, largely that it's men who don't know, or males who don't know what healthy masculinity looks like. The kind of buzzword of toxic masculinity gets thrown out a lot now, and I think that can be counterproductive, as you're letting the problem dictate the terms. So again, like being about what's healthy masculinity look like, and in my case, I think martial arts would have accomplished that. Growing up, I did live in a well-to-do suburb, and I had a nice house, and by world standards, my family was incredibly wealthy, but by the standards of my suburb, I was like the poor kid. And all my friends took taekwondo and karate, and I was like obsessed with anything Asian and anything having to do with martial arts, and my parents just couldn't afford to send me, and so there was a lot of angst about that. I was angry about that. And then one summer through the rec program, there was a 6-week judo course for like $75 or something. And my parents put me in, and I was so stoked. And my sensei was a woman who was an Olympic judokan. And she was pretty slight, but this is a class of adults and kids. And she would just like be whipping grown men around like it was nothing. And at that point, there was not an adult in my life that I would listen to or that could command my attention or my discipline. But when I was just in the presence of this woman, I was just standing there at attention, like waiting for her order. And I loved judo, and I was pretty good at it. And I got my orange belt in 6 weeks. I was in tournaments, and all I wanted to do was continue. But then after the 6 weeks, they're like, yeah, it's $75 a week now. So that my parents couldn't afford that, and it kind of had a definitely opposite effect, because now I'm like really angry that I can't continue with judo, but I'm like more dangerous than I was. And even going into as a teenager, I used a lot of the fighting moves I was taught without retaining the real spiritual kind of Zen warrior aspect of martial arts. So I think with a good teacher, martial arts is a really powerful way to divert young men from violence. And it's important to understand, too, that like testosterone is not going anywhere. You got to manage it. And sometimes for some kids, that means rough stuff is the best way to do it. So martial arts, football, hockey, wrestling, those things, if they're done with a coach or a trainer who really addresses the spiritual aspect of it as well, it can be a great way to sort that out.
Interesting. So you encounter this music, and it pushes you further in this direction. But were you, in those teenage years, are you thinking about the actual ideas of white supremacy, about racial difference, or are you further just finding ways to, again, to quote you, piss more people off?
Yeah, it was definitely pissing people off. It was, nothing pisses people off, swastika. I wasn't ignorant as to why. I knew why people were repulsed by that symbol. I knew about the Holocaust, but in the same way that, like, a heroin junkie knows it's wrong to steal things or even prostitute themselves to support their habit, and they don't feel good about it. In the end, they don't care as long as they're getting their heroin. And for me, it was very similar. I knew why the swastika was wrong and why it repulsed people, but I didn't care as long as I was getting that rush of when you can just like flash a symbol or say a word and you get everybody to freak out and just lose it, like it's a false sense of power. And it's thrilling. It was very attractive to me. So I didn't come in as like a racist looking for other racists. I just came in as this messed up kid looking for the best way to shock people and repulse people. And then once I started radiating hate and violence out into the world and the world started reflecting it back, that's when I started to actually dig deep into the ideology itself and start to buy into it.
Hmm. When did you get your first Nazi tattoo?
Probably, 16. I that's when I got the swastika on my middle finger. I had a Celtic cross on my left arm, and then I also had a thing that said Skins, and the two S's were like SS bolts. And these are all like homemade tattoos, yeah, which were just super gnarly looking. And nowadays I have just about all of them either removed or covered up.
I would urge our listeners, if you can fit it into your calendar and you can join them next Thursday night, because we can't cover it all. And frankly, you got to pick up the book and you got to be there next Thursday if you can do it, for the event in Rochester. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Arno Michaelis and Pardeep Kaleka, who are going to be here in Rochester next Thursday. Karen Elam is the director of the Levine Center to End Hate at the Jewish Federation of Greater Rochester. They've put together this event for next Thursday. Remind our listeners what they need to know about the event and how to get tickets.
Sure. So, again, it's at the Lyric Theater, Thursday, November 21st, 7 p.m. Go to endhaterock.org for tickets.
So let's get our only break of the hour, and when we come back with Pardeep and Arno, we're going to talk about what happened that led to that shooting and then how they have built this friendship and what they urge everyone who might doubt or fear people who are different to do about that fear. That's coming up next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester City School District Superintendent Terry Day joins us. He has released some strategies for dealing with the budget long term that he hopes will keep the district out of the mess it got into before he got here. That mess includes a $30 million budget gap, and the superintendent says it's time to get a lot more realistic about how we put together these budgets. But what about teaching cuts? What about other strategies? We talk about it next hour with Terry Day. This is Connections. Our guests joining us from Milwaukee this hour are the co-authors of the book, The Gift of Our Wounds, A Sikh and Former White Supremacist Find Forgiveness After Hate. That former white supremacist is Arno Michaelis, who's one of our guests. He is describing his own childhood, the pain that he felt, and the direction he took in his teenage years that led him to white supremacy, eventually the creation of this gang that years later was responsible for a mass shooting at a Sikh temple in Milwaukee that took the lives of six people, including Pardeep Kaleka's father, who died in that shooting. And they co-authored this book about forgiveness, about how we hate, but also how we can move beyond that. And they're coming to Rochester, as we mentioned, as guests of the Levine Center to End Hate next Thursday night. Karen Elam's the director of the center, and there's something else you want to mention as well.
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to mention that the two gentlemen, Arno and Pardeep, will be leading a book discussion on that Thursday, November 21st at noon at the Central Library.
Next Thursday, noon, the Central Library in Rochester.
Correct.
A book discussion about the gift of our wounds and then the 7 o'clock event at the Lyric Theater.
Correct.
So two chances to meet them and to learn more. And so we've gotten Arno's story up to the point where he is an adult now. And when did it kind of move Arno in the direction of actually creating and seeking out others who you know, felt like you felt and you wanted to create some kind of a gang? How did that happen?
Well, when I was 16, I it was myself and a few friends who first started the skinhead gang. And I had been screaming in punk bands for a couple of years and I was pretty good at it. So my buddy played guitar, the other guy played drums. So we started our own skinhead band as well. And with that band as kind of the flagship, our group grew very quickly, and we started getting the attention of other like old school white nationalist organizations around the country, as well as other skinhead gangs around the country. And we went pretty quickly from just a couple guys to 10, 20, 30, peaking in like 91-ish at about 150 people locally.
I think what I want to ask you, Arno, is to describe, if I could, knowing that time is a little bit limited, There's a couple of events that stand out to us. And if you could tell us a little bit more about, I think the comment that was made at a Thanksgiving dinner when you thought at the time identity was all that mattered was the color of your skin. And, you know, you're at Thanksgiving dinner and drinking and your mom says something. What happens?
Yeah, our Thanksgivings they're amazing, but also as dysfunctional as any other Thanksgivings. It's funny about that dichotomy, but I was drunk and like in the depths of my ideology and there with my skinhead girlfriend, and I'm going on about all my white power ideology, and my mom goes, "Well, Mr. Nazi, did you know that your great grandpa was part Native American? So you're 1/16th Indian?" And I lost it. I was like, "I am not an Indian. I'm not a mud race," and rah rah rah. And I went stomping out of there and went home to this dingy apartment that I share with my girlfriend. I locked myself in the bedroom and was working through a case of beer bottles and glass bottles, and I broke one of the bottles and started carving up my wrist with it. And that was the first of two suicide attempts, both of which were fortunately foiled by different skinhead girlfriends who fortunately were not faint at the sight of blood and knew enough first aid to stop me from bleeding out. But it's an example of just how miserable it is to live your life like that. It's not something I'd wish on my worst enemy.
And then there was another occasion where you're at McDonald's and an African-American woman is at the register, and you wrote that she had a warm smile and she noticed the swastika tattoo on your finger. And what did she say to you?
Well, first she said, "What is that on your finger?" And I felt like when my beloved grandmother was admonishing me for beating up my little brother. I was ashamed, and I wanted to please her because she was so nice, but I didn't have anything to say in my defense, so I'm just like, "Well, it's nothing." And she waited for me to look up, and when her eyes met, she said, I know that's not who you are. You're a better person than that." And I literally grabbed my food and, like, ran out of that McDonald's because her kindness was just destroying everything I was trying to stake my identity in. And I was absolutely defenseless by it. And I'd love to say that I went skipping out of the McDonald's cured of my racism, but actually I went home and I got as drunk as I could, as fast as I could. And I went on the streets and then just attacked the first person I could find because I was trying to put distance between myself and this like singularity of humanity I just experienced. And that incident was a big factor in my turnaround, along with other acts of kindness from people like a Jewish boss or a lesbian supervisor or Black and Latino coworkers. That kindness really indicated more powerfully than anything else how wrong I was. And I'm grateful for that every day.
And so fast forwarding a bit, what was the moment that you knew that this was no longer who you were? That it was that part of your life was over?
It was probably like a few weeks after the milestone night was after a concert my band had played in like April-ish of 94, and a second friend of mine was murdered in a street fight. That's when I'm like, I can't do this anymore, and I just started walking away. And I had one friend who kind of dipped his toes in the gang and then got out quick, and I went and hung out with him. And I'm laying on his bedroom floor, and we're listening to the Beastie Boys' Check Your Head. And I'm just like, if listening to a bunch of Jewish guys doing black people music is wrong, I don't want to be right. And it was just such a almost hedonistic feeling of just being free to listen to whatever you wanted to and root for the Green Bay Packers and watch Seinfeld and movies out of Hollywood. And most importantly, just to talk to anybody I wanted to talk to. It was a huge weight off my shoulders. And I was very clear at that point that I was not going back.
When did you know that it was someone from that gang that you had helped create that was responsible for the mass shooting in 2012?
The evening of the shooting, probably about the time that Pardeep's family was finding out that Satwant had been killed, they announced that the shooter was an affiliated white nationalist. But that's it. They didn't announce his name, and they didn't go into the particulars of the group. But right at that point, I just had this sinking feeling that I had something to do with this. And that feeling was kind of going all day, but it was really affirmed when they said, yes, it was a white nationalist. And I lay awake that night wondering if it was someone I had recruited personally. And the next day, when his name was announced, I was able to kind of connect some dots and establish that I didn't know him personally, but it also came out then that he was part of Hammerskin Nation. And while Hammerskin Nation was not my idea, and it would have existed had I never, I was still like very busy at the beginning of it and working to organize it and spread it around the world. So I felt the real urgency to respond, and I still feel that urgency today.
Hmm. Pardeep, when did you feel comfortable that you could actually have a friendship with this man?
When we met. The first time that we met, I think for what happened on August 5th, really that we had a responsibility, and I felt that responsibility. I was 35 years old at the time. I've sort of been a bridge between the older generation, the newer generation, the first generation immigrants, the second generation immigrants. I knew that we had a responsibility to the community, the broader community. We had a responsibility to our own personal community, and then we all have a responsibility to ourselves as well. I negated myself for a very long time, trying to raise money, take care of logistics for people that lost their family members, and really trying to handle responsibilities that my father had for business and within the family and the Sangat and the Gurdwara. But at the same time, I knew that I needed to return to self to be in a better place. And we all got to do that where we can dedicate ourselves to community and the broader community, our personal community, whatever that personal community looks like. But you always got to come back to yourself and really address what is happening internally. And so meeting Arnold, what I didn't know it at the time, was really an addressing of self and saying, okay, how do you really forgive? And what does that look like? It might not look like somebody else's journey, but what's your own personal journey with forgiveness and how do we move forward?
Arnold, what did it mean to you?
I was incredibly honored when I first heard from Pardeep, a bit intimidated as well. Just feeling like there was nothing I could say that would be good enough or adequate to express the sorrow I felt. But it's one of these things that, and Pardeep has been an amazing example of this over and over again, and tragically, as these white nationalist attacks keep happening, and really any violent extremist attack, people just come in and you don't know what you're going to do and how you're going to respond, but you just show up. And for me, as intimidated as I was, I'm going to show up for sure and just offer myself to this guy and his family and his community. And I didn't know how I could help them heal, but I wanted to let them know I was there and ready to do whatever it took. And when Pardeep and I sat down for dinner finally and started talking, I had to remind myself throughout the 4 hours we sat and talked, as I do now often, that like I'm meeting this guy because a guy from my old gang murdered his dad and 5 other people. When you meet Pardeep, he's just one of the most easygoing and down-to-earth and just warm people you ever met. And it's hard to get your head around the fact that he's survived this kind of trauma. And he's not only survived it, but he's come out of it to help other people heal and help his community heal. So to me, it was really one of the best days of my life, right up there with my daughter being born and the day I quit drinking and talking to Jason Alexander on the phone, which I did a couple months ago.
Jason Alexander of Seinfeld fame?
Yes. I also talked to Wayne Knight, and he interviewed me on Peter Tilden's KABC show in Los Angeles. That was pretty awesome.
Newman and George.
Yep.
Well, I want to ask Karen Elam, director of the Levine Center to End Hate, what you make of this unlikely friendship and the lessons that you hope it has in 2019.
Well, I have to tell you both, Arno and Pardeep, thank you so much. It's just sitting here has been incredibly powerful, and we haven't had the chance to meet each other in person yet. I can't wait to do that next week, but I just really want to thank you for digging in and sharing what you shared on this program. And frankly, it's interesting. I was sitting here thinking, you know, your book, The Gift of Our Wounds, I'm realizing you're bringing us a gift in this community. You're bringing us the gift of your powerful story and allowing us then to take it and unpack it and look at what the lessons are that we can take from it. And then from there, how we can really do the work that we need to do to end hate and to come together and see each other's humanity. And as you said earlier, Pardeep, really finding the love that we need to have with each other. And, you know, if the two of you could bridge this divide, then I think most of us could do it as well. Mm. So I just thank you very much.
Thank you, Kerr.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. And let me read some messages from a listener named Don, who identifies as a white nationalist, who I have to say, and I want to direct this to Arno, because Arno's sort of been there, but, you know, Arno, you describe your path to white supremacy and then your path out of it as having been hurt, someone who wanted to inflame things, someone who wanted the thrill of getting a reaction, even if it meant hurting people to get that reaction. I've read a lot of white nationalist literature in recent years. I've tried to understand it. People have different routes to it. And the writer of this email has a very different sort of background. He's a former Obama voter, became very suspicious after Ferguson and Black Lives Matter, and generally views violence as abhorrent, but is worried that the human lesson throughout history is that difference equals strife, and that we just can't escape that. Obviously, I understand the concern, but I also firmly disagree, and I find that incredibly giving up in the face of the great human experiment that we have right now. I mean, might as well close civilization and go home if that's the view. But let me go ahead and read his message. He says, it sounds like Arno's hate and his reform are personal things, as in how should we treat each other? And in that sense, I totally endorse the message and the show for getting the message out. We should treat each other well. But my focus isn't a personal one. It's a political one. How should we organize ourselves and act collectively? And in my opinion, it's fair to organize around race and advocate for ourselves. I think and maybe hope that people are capable of making that distinction, advocating for us while still being decent to others, even if they aren't us. So I'm wondering if Arno thinks that's a fair distinction. Take any number of black organizations as an example. You wouldn't want or expect Black Lives Matter organizers to be personally hateful toward individual people, but you'd expect them to advocate for the interests of black people. Is it even possible in principle for white people to pull off something similar? Arno?
Well, it's an old trope in white nationalist recruiting, which this guy's touching on. And I appreciate his civility and his willingness to engage. That's what's most important. It's important that we listen to him. But he is right in one point that tribalism is as old as humanity itself. It's always something that we'll struggle with. But I've come to understand that we define our tribe. It's when we sit there and just throw our hands up and go, oh, society defines me, the racial construct defines me. I agree with you. I think it's given up. And as someone who once looked at the world through a lens that agreed with this man's standpoint, saying I'm different than everybody else because I'm white, more different than alike, and at war with everybody else, that had a corresponding effect on my life, and it was essentially misery. And today, I willfully look through a different lens that says human beings have far more in common than different. And I've been so graced to travel around the world exploring that. I'm leaving from Racine, Wisconsin to Venice, Italy tonight to work with 40 people from around the world in combating violent extremism through arts and culture. And in all of my work, it's affirmed over and over and over again that diversity is a beautiful, powerful thing. And science affirms that as well. If you look at any ecosystem, the measure of the health of that ecosystem is its diversity. Any ecosystem that has that's segregated or has a wrong proportion of one species or subspecies of another is a failing one. And so this idea of organizing by the racial construct, it's caused nothing but suffering for the past 500 years. And I don't think that it's a solution to any kind of problem. I would invite the guy who wrote this to come out to dinner with me and we'll sit and talk, and I have no problem doing that. But when I do intervention with people who are under the yoke of these ideologies, the first thing I want to show them is that there's a different way to live your life, and it's just much healthier and happier. And when you organize your tribe as a tribe of humanity, which every single human being has the capacity to do, it's going to have not only a corresponding healthy effect on your life, but on society as well.
Now, the point about monocultures in nature being either unhealthy or not able to survive and thrive is such an interesting and true observation. Anybody who's tried to grow a front lawn,
right.
The damn dandelions. Well, guess what? That's just nature.
Exactly.
You got to do it. You got to do a lot of destructive things just to put a monoculture out there. It's not a peaceful thing to create a monoculture. It's actually quite destructive.
I'd add to that as well. I have a brilliant friend, Chloe Valdery, who has a program called Theory of Enchantment, and she pointed out that even, when was Europe all white? You'd have a hard time establishing that to begin with. But if you say, okay, in the Middle Ages, it was all white. What was happening then when they had this white, Shangri-La? It was the Dark Ages. They were burning each other at the stake as witches, fighting like cats and dogs constantly. Spanish Inquisition. It wasn't like a healthy state for anybody involved. So it really rings true for many cultural groups going back through history.
Hey,
so
Arno, tell your friend Chloe I'd love to have her on this program. She's on high on the list of guests who have never been on the program that I'd love to have.
You must.
Yeah,
absolutely brilliant.
She is on the list for sure. And Pardeep, you talk quite often, from what I can see, about the importance of really intentionally pushing ourselves outside of whatever sort of structural bubbles we create. And I know that sounds simplistic, and I know we hear it a lot, but tell me about how you do that and the impact you see it having.
I think you do it deliberately. We're all prone to confirmation bias and identity-motivated reasoning. That's what you're kind of seeing right now, whatever you stake your identity in. And oftentimes it's a defense mechanism. It's, I'd rather you attack my identity than attack me. I'd rather you reject my identity than reject me, because if you reject me, it hurts too bad. So I'm going to take up this identity, and whatever that is. A lot of people are single party voters. Some people are think, and you can feed yourself with the echoes, like with the information that you want to feed that identity in, with. And I think if you don't deliberately get out of that bubble, if you deliberately don't look for it, unintentionally, it's gonna silo you, and it's gonna silo your mindset. The one other constant in life is that we all change. Societies change. We evolve. We get to a place, and a lot of times people are over-intellectualizing certain problems. They convince themselves and they form sort of discussions around civility and all of these things to say, hey, look, I'm saying this in a nice way, and how smart do I look or sound? And I'm at that place where I'm just like, you sound fearful. You sound like you're holding on to something. And how much work does that really take? How much does that put onto you? What are you so scared of? Getting to a place where we're spiritually vibrating at a different level is going to take us challenging ourselves. And I think we can look at it right now and say, it's horrible what is happening in our country right now. It's horrible the politics and the divisive rhetoric. But this is also needed, because we weren't going to get to when this shooting happened, we talked about America being a post-racial society in 2012. This is what we had convinced ourselves of. Lots of people knew in that part where we feel, rather than we think, that this wasn't. And it took this to convince everybody to say, listen, we got a lot of work to do, and we're going to do this work, and we're going to do this work together. And that's going to take us challenging each and every one of us.
I want to thank our guests for the time this hour. You just heard Pardeep Kalecka and Arno Michaelis. They are the co-authors of The Gift of Our Wounds, A Sikh and Former White Supremacist Find Forgiveness After Hate. Pardeep lost his father in that mass shooting in 2012. And the shooting was committed by a member of the gang that Arno founded years before, but they have created a friendship, a forgiveness, and a powerful message. They're bringing it to Rochester 1 week from today. So next Thursday at noon, they're doing a book talk at the Central Library in Rochester. I know they'd love to meet you there, and the book will be available there. Karen Elam is the director of the Levine Center to End Hate. Why don't you remind our listeners when they can meet Arno and Pardeep next Thursday night?
So the program, Why Do We Hate, next Thursday, November 21st, 7 p.m., Lyric Theater. Get tickets at endhaterock, that's endhateroc.org. And we are quickly selling out, so please be sure to get your tickets. And I just want to thank you so much, Evan, and thank you, Arno and Pardeep.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Karen.
Arno and Pardeep, all the love to you for the message that you're spreading and the way that you take it around the country and around the world. And Arno, I'm so sorry you have to go to Italy, but make the best of it as best as you can, man.
It's going to be pretty damp, I understand.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Flooding.
You got... Yeah. No. You don't get to do that. Arno, Pardeep, all the best to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
God bless.
Joining us from Milwaukee this hour. And thanks, by the way, to Mike Black and the whole team for helping put together this conversation. Wow, powerful stuff. And maybe you can meet them a week from today. More connections coming up.